From the Schmoes No Network Studios in Los Angeles, California, it's time for Profiles with your hosts, Alicia Malone and Scott Mantz.
Hello, Schmoville!
Welcome to our sixth episode of Profiles, number six. This episode is going to be our best one yet because we are going to be talking about a director that even more than Martin Scorsese, you have asked for the most,
Quentin Tarantino. One of my favorite directors of all time. I think because he loves movies so much. He has such a great style, but I think of him almost like a video store in that you get all these mix of genres together. So you'll get a Western movie next to a martial arts film, a kung fu movie next to, I don't know, a gangster film. I love how he blends genres. I love all the homages to all the great movies in there. His style is often copied, but it can never quite reach the heights that Quentin does.
And some filmmakers have tried. Some have come pretty close, and we'll get to that later on. But yes, Quentin Tarantino, his movies are so hyper-stylized.
And the dialogue.
The dialogue. He makes it sound so natural and so easy, when in fact, writing dialogue like that is hard to do. But his style as a screenwriter is just as strong as his style as a director.
So rare.
So rare. He's broken ground. But who is this unusual character named Quentin Tarantino, Alicia Malone?
Let's find out in our segment called
It's a Wonderful Life.
Take it away.
Quentin Jerome Tarantino was born on March 27, 1963 in Knoxville, Tennessee. His father, Tony Tarantino, was an Italian-American actor and musician from Queens, New York. When he was 4 years old, Quentin moved with his mother to Torrance, California, and later to Harbor City. He dropped out of high school when he was 15 to attend the James Best Theater Company, but soon grew bored with it and left after 2 years. While his mother's boyfriends took him to see blaxploitation movies, it was while he worked at Video Archives, a home video store in Manhattan Beach, California, that he found inspiration for his career as a director. Since 1992, Tarantino has been nominated for an Oscar 5 times and won twice, both for Best Original Screenplay, first for Pulp Fiction, and then Django Unchained. Tarantino has never been married, has no kids, and his friends call him QT.
Don't you want to just walk slow motion to that track?
I want to watch Reservoir Dogs right now because of that track. It is so awesome. But what was your first blood? What was your introduction to Quentin Tarantino?
It was Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
I used to go to the video store and get a stack of movies. It was $7 for 7 days for 7 films. So I would always pick a mixture of classic films and new releases. And Pulp Fiction was one I hadn't seen. I was technically underage for the rating, but never mind, the video store guy knew me, so he trusted me. And I have to say, that movie blew my mind.
Oh yeah,
I had never seen anything like it. The non-linear storyline, which we will talk a lot about because one of his trademarks, that was something so new and so fresh. I loved Mia Wallace, what a great character, and loved seeing John Travolta in that role. And actually after that, that's when I discovered Quentin Tarantino, but I also discovered Miramax. And so from then on, just having that logo at the start of a movie saying Miramax meant that it was a film I was going to enjoy.
Yeah, Miramax was a big sign of quality because of the Weinstein brothers.
Yeah.
But full disclosure, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Quentin Tarantino did work at a video store. That is where he found inspiration to do so many of his films. And my Profiles co-host, Alicia Malone, also worked at a video store.
I did.
How
I worked
long?
At Video Easy in Sydney for a few years. I loved it.
I'll bet.
It was the best. And actually, I used to get in trouble all the time for putting on Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction because the people were like, it's a little too violent, especially for the day. You've got kids coming in here, maybe not. So then I would put on Little Mermaid or something else. But yeah, I feel the same as Quentin. I feel like a kinship in that way, although I don't have as much knowledge as he does because he is incredible.
No filmmaker is a bigger film nerd than Quentin Tarantino.
He's
seen things that like we didn't even know existed.
He's seen these really obscure Australian movies, these Ozploitation films, and he appears in a documentary about them. Some I've never heard of before. It's incredible. What was your first blood?
Well, my first blood was Reservoir Dogs, which I saw in the theater when it came out in October of 1992.
Wow.
And I remember I remember I was my first year living in Los Angeles, and I saw in the newspaper this ad that had these five guys all wearing black suits, skinny ties, and sunglasses, and I saw the name Reservoir Dogs. I said, that sounded really cool. No idea who Quentin Tarantino was. I didn't know that it was a big Sundance hit. Mm-hmm. Go see the movie. First thing I notice is the dialogue, talking about tipping,
yes,
and making it sound so engaging.
Exactly.
And then just the violence of that film, the bloodshed of that movie. And I'd never seen anything like that. And it's also the structure, the nonlinear structure.
Yeah,
this is
so
a
interesting.
Heist. So interesting. This is a heist movie where you never actually see the heist.
With no heist.
No heist. And whatever happened, something went down. There's a rat in the bunch. Just it was my first movie. It was the first movie for a lot of people because it just broke him through.
Yeah, I want to throw this to Chate. He doesn't know I'm going to do this, but Chate, do you have a first blood? Do you remember your first Quentin movie?
Yeah, it was Pulp Fiction theaters.
Oh, cool.
My parents, I had to beg them to take me. My mom and my grandmother took me to go see it.
Wow.
Let me tell you something.
Your grandmother?
Yeah, my grandmother. They were like, we had to go to like an hour away because it was only playing in a small theater. And I just remember thinking, there's a couple scenes in that movie, Ving Rhames, Bruce Willis, where I was like, oh my God.
What is this?
Yes. The only thing that saved me was I liked to sit in a certain part of the theater, and they wanted to sit in the back, so I sat in the middle.
Good.
Knowing they're in the theater still creeped me out, but...
Yeah, your grandmother and the kid sees the gimp.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I think they regretted bringing me to it, yeah. But I loved it. And like you said, the structure is so different. It kind of blew my film mind.
Yeah, me too. Just an incredible movie. And we'll be getting into all that in our Fast Five. So let's kick it off with number five, which is...
D-J-A-N-G-O. The D is silent.
The D is silent.
Django Unchained.
This movie came out on Christmas Day 2012.
I saw it on Christmas Day.
Because really, right? Nothing says Christmas more than Quentin Tarantino.
That's right. In my opinion, yes.
Well, this was a big movie. Isn't it his highest grossing film?
It is his highest grossing film ever, and such a great revenge western, which of course is what he's going to do next, and I can't wait to see that.
Its
inspiration from a 1966 western called Django, and Franco Nero, who starred in that movie, has a nice little cameo. He's the one who asks Jamie Foxx how to spell the name in that clip that we just heard. I really enjoyed this film. It is quite dark and brutal, even for Quentin's standards.
Definitely.
Because of the subject matter.
Well, also, it is a revenge thriller that followed another revenge thriller, 2009's Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, and both of them are kind of Quentin's wish for how history would have turned out.
Right. It is a revenge fantasy.
Yeah.
And both of those movies followed another big revenge fantasy, not including 2007's the Grindhouse movie,
mm-hmm.
but those, the Kill Bill movies.
Yep.
That's an epic revenge fantasy. But this movie was shot in a course of 130 days.
Wow.
It was Quentin Tarantino's longest shoot to date.
Wow. It was also interesting seeing Leonardo DiCaprio in that role.
Yeah.
It was his first real villain role and his first time, I think, in 16 years that he wasn't the top billing star. Christoph Waltz as well. He won his second Oscar for this movie.
And his first one was from Inglourious Basterds. So working with Quentin Tarantino
pays off.
It's like a gold charm, a lucky charm.
The only thing I didn't like about this movie were the Australian accents. Apparently, Quentin wasn't supposed to be in that role. It was meant for Anthony LaPaglia, but he pulled out. So Quentin decided last minute to save money and save time and just do it himself. He does a terrible Australian accent, but nice to see John Jarrett, who was in Wolf Creek, a movie that Quentin really loved. Nice to see him get a role in this film as well.
Well, also, this was, like you said about Leonardo DiCaprio, but originally, DiCaprio didn't feel comfortable about playing somebody so unlikable and evil. And Tarantino had to say to him, no, man, you have to go for this. You have to pull out all the stops or people will never forgive you. And it paid off because it definitely is one of Leonardo DiCaprio's best roles.
Remember that scene where he's talking about phrenology and he has this the skull,
yeah,
and then he slams his hand on the table. He started bleeding during that scene for real, kept going, used his pain.
Oh yeah.
I love how this is a spaghetti western as well and kind of a blaxploitation film. Great actors in this. I thought Jamie Foxx did an incredible job.
Yeah, he really did. And Christoph Waltz, he won for best supporting actor, but because he had 1 hour, 6 minutes, and 17 seconds of screen time.
Wow.
His is the longest running supporting actor win in Oscar history.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Also interesting was Roger Ebert's, or the New York Times review
yep.
from A.O. Scott. He said it was crazily entertaining, brazenly irresponsible, ethically serious in a way that is consistent with its playfulness.
That's a good summation of it.
Yes.
Well, let's see what Schmoville thought about Django Unchained. Cole Boone. Hey, Cole.
Hey, Cole.
Cole said Django Unchained was actually his first Tarantino film. Wow. And he said he really enjoyed the clever wit, gratuitous violence, and award-worthy acting by Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Samuel L. Jackson. This film will always have a special place in my heart because it was my first blood. Thanks for that, Cole.
Don't you love when our friends in Schmoville, what they've been doing on Facebook lately?
Oh, incredible.
They've been coming up with their own Fast Five.
Yep.
Their own First Blood.
Their own right stuff.
Their own good, bad, and ugly.
Yes.
We love that. So keep doing that.
And like I love interacting with the fans because they are film fans just like us.
And it's so fun. We just love your support. Thank you so much. And please go to our fan page, Profiles with Malone and Mance, on Facebook, and
give us a like
and go to iTunes and give us a rating and a review so we can keep coming back all the time.
It.
We have so much to get into. We're just getting started on Profiles.
We are.
Well, Michael K, our other friend from Schmoville, says, first off, I love Westerns, so when this film was first announced, it already had my curiosity. The more I heard about the film, especially who was cast as the main protagonist, it grabbed my attention even more. I think this might be one of my favorite screenplays ever done. Speaking of which, everyone should check out Vertigo Comics' graphic novel adaptation of Django Unchained.
Oh, interesting.
It's a direct adaptation of the first draft of the screenplay, and it is every bit as awesome as the movie. Thanks.
Good tip.
Michael K., good tip.
Yeah, okay.
Right on.
Now we get to our right stuff, starting off with me.
Your favorite scene.
Pulp Fiction.
Oh,
because okay. I said before how I love Mia Wallace, even though she is kind of a bad character. She's got some problems, but she's still really cool. So I became a little bit obsessed with her after first seeing Pulp Fiction. I remember tracking down the exact nail polish that she wore.
Oh, you really got into her.
Nail polish so I could wear the same one. I didn't quite dye my hair the same, but I loved her. Uma Thurman, I thought, was incredible. So the scene in Jackrabbit Slims with John Travolta is my favorite because the dialogue is so good and that place looks like somewhere I really want to go.
I would love to go to Jackrabbit Slims.
I want to have a $5 shake.
It's a wax museum with a pulse.
Yeah, exactly. And so my favorite bit, and someone's already requested this on Schmoville.
Oh, cool. Here it is.
Is at the Fox Force 5. So I love when she says, Fox is in where a bunch of foxy chicks. Force is in where... I can't do the accent. I'll try again. Fox is where, as in where a bunch of foxy chicks. Force as in where a force to be reckoned with. Five as in there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us.
Way to go!
Forget my accent, but I love that scene. I think it's really cool. And John Travolta, so good.
John Travolta, his comeback movie made him super, super cool. There are a lot of details in Quentin Tarantino's movies. I mean, there are so many Easter eggs in his movies if you're a film buff. So in our section, we like to call it The Last Detail, which is our Quentin Tarantino trivia.
Yes.
Did you know that while filming Django Unchained in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that Quentin Tarantino, in a foreshadowing and an omen of things to come, he rented out the local theater and he would show Westerns and samurai movies to the cast, but they were Westerns and samurai movies pulled from his own collection.
Oh, that's so cool. And he's doing the same with the New Beverly Cinema, which he's owned for a while, but now here in LA, he's going to be taking over the programming. I'm so excited about this because he's going to show prints from his own collection.
And we will be there.
We will be there.
We
I'm
will
be there,
there
every night of the week. I'm so excited. Well, did you know that the hands in Inglourious Basterds who is strangling Bridget von Hammersmark
that
actually
Diane
belonged
Kruger?
To Quentin Tarantino?
Wait, it wasn't Christoph Waltz?
No, I'm not sure why Quentin stepped in.
Maybe he had a grudge.
Interesting.
Interesting. It's one of the things that, like the spelling of the title, makes you go, wonder why he chose to do that himself. Well, did you know that in Pulp Fiction, the first actor who went after the role of Vincent Vega, not John Travolta, Daniel Day-Lewis.
What?
Daniel Day-Lewis wanted to play...
Can you imagine that?
I can't, because Travolta was great.
He was so great, and...
Tarantino turned him down.
He turned Daniel Day-Lewis
Tarantino
down?
Tarantino turned Daniel Day-Lewis down.
Wow.
And James Gandolfini was also considered briefly.
I can kind of imagine that one.
I can see that one. Yeah. Because it's Gandolfini. It's a tough guy.
Gangster.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, well, did you know that more than 450 gallons of fake blood were used for Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2. I bet you can believe that.
After seeing the way...
The Crazy 88?
The Crazy 88, whenever somebody got their head chopped off or their arm, like a geyser of blood.
Crazy. I'm glad it went black and white at that point. But that leads us nicely into talking about our Fast Five number 4, which is...
Could you do what you did? Of course you could. But I never thought you would or could do that.
Talking about Kill Bill Volume 2.
Oh, Volume 2, which came out on April 16th, 2004. Alicia, isn't it amazing that both of these Kill Bill movies were shot at the same time?
Mm-hmm. And Quentin considers them as one movie.
But they feel completely different.
They're so different. The Volume first one is what? Lots of action.
Lots of action. Over the top action. Like you're just talking about the Crazy 88. Yeah. By the way, there aren't actually 88 of them.
No.
They just thought it sounded thought it cool.
It does sound cool.
but Kill Bill Volume 2 is a far better film. It's not as over the top, but it still has great fight scenes.
Yep.
And I know that you were mentioning this the other day when we were going through all this, but there's just so much more depth to this film, isn't there?
More character development in this one. We get to see Bill.
Yes.
Whereas we only hear of Bill in Volume 1.
Right.
And they say, you know, Volume 1 is more about Japanese samurai films and kung fu flicks, and Volume 2 has more of a spaghetti western
yep.
feel to it, as well as those 70s Chinese martial arts movies. Uma Thurman, for me, this is such a great role. And it's funny, I was talking about Fox Force 5 before. It kind of is the plot of Kill Bill.
Yeah, it is. And Uma Thurman, why she did not get nominated for this movie is beyond me. Well, I guess maybe because it's just too violent or whatever, but it was
the Academy members wouldn't want to sit through that.
Yeah, Kill Bill Volume 2, yeah. Like 84-year-old Academy member.
Yeah,
I don't think
come
so.
On.
But didn't she just give a performance that was physically and emotionally grueling and all over the map, every emotion.
100% commitment.
Yes, and you see like her daughter.
Yeah.
And there was just a lot more emotional depth to this character. And David Carradine was fantastic. Also should have been nominated for an Oscar for this movie.
It's one of the great things Quentin does is he takes these actors that we've forgotten about and he casts them in these roles. David was brilliant as Bill, really humanized him.
Definitely. And, you know, listen, this is an epic revenge tale like we talked about where we're
killing off the deadly Viper assassination squad.
But there are so many great scenes in this movie. Listen, I love the scene, and I know you do too, near the end when the bride goes to confront Bill and he starts talking to her all about
Superman.
Let's talk about that scene.
I love that scene. And it was one when I watched it, I was like, oh yeah, it actually makes a lot of sense, talking about how Superman is different from the other superheroes in that his identity that he assumes is not the superhero. It is the human, and it's actually a play on how he perceives humanity, this kind of boring, bumbling type character in Clark Kent.
And I remember when I was watching that movie, as it was unfolding for the first time before my eyes, hearing that dialogue and just going, wow, like really, really makes you think. But of course, I mean, I just also love the scene when she's in the coffin and she has to flash back to Pai Mei, you know, and she's trying to get out, and she flashes back to her courtship
training.
And training and all that. And that was just such a great scene. Mm-hmm. And of course, the fight scene between Daryl Hannah.
That's my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
That standoff, and there's no music. It's just the sound of the eye being poked out.
Well,
which was crazy.
It was so crazy. And then she steps on it.
Yeah. And I want to say a big shout out to Zoe Bell, who's a New Zealand stunt woman. And she did the stunts for Uma in those movies. Great job. And then we got to see her
in Death Proof.
In Death Proof, yeah.
Right on. Well, here's an excerpt from a review that was written back in 2004.
Yep.
Not only is Kill Bill 2 superior to Volume 1 in just about every way, but it might be as good as 1994's Pulp Fiction in terms of sheer brilliance.
Mm.
The dialogue is sharper. The humor is more ironic, the performances are stronger, and there is a lot more emotional depth to the characters. Guess who wrote that review?
Hey.
This guy!
This guy!
Movie Nance 2004, ladies
Movie
and gentlemen.
Nance. Well, Joshua Willingham says that Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2, which he considers to be one long movie, is his favorite. It's got one of the strongest and toughest female leads in the last 10 years.
Woohoo!
Yes. Tarantino knows how much to go over the top with his action and gore, and he incorporates it so well into these films. The dialogue he writes proves he is the greatest writer-director ever, in my opinion, and his talent is shown in full glory with the Superman monologue Bill gives to the bride. Yeah, we totally agree.
Okay, Claudia Rose Weldon. Hi, Claudia.
Yay, Claudia.
My very favorite Tarantino films are the Kill Bill films. Paying tribute to exploitation and the kung fu movies is something that some directors would do with a wink, but Tarantino takes the material and the genre seriously,
yes,
highlighting its best attributes in the characters, tone, and story. Uma Thurman is the best female action star of the decade.
Yay!
Woohoo! And David Carradine is amazing in what should have been, yeah, we agree, yes, an Oscar-winning performance as Bill. It's Tarantino doing what he loves the most, and it's an entertaining, excellent salute to a genre that's massively overlooked. Claudia Rose Weldon, if I didn't know any better, I'd swear you were a film critic.
She's great. She's really great. Fantastic opinions. Well, let's get to the big picture, because Tarantino has some great posters.
Oh, yeah.
I was telling you how when I was young, I had Mr. Blonde from Reservoir Dogs hanging over my bed. So every time when I woke up, I would just see him with his gun pointing down at me.
Mr. Blonde.
Mom came in and was like, "Are you sure you want that poster? It's very violent." I was like, "It's Mr. Blonde, Mom. He's so cool."
But you're such a lovely, dear, sweet, nice person. You have this dark side.
Everyone else had Beverly Hills 90210 on their walls. I had Reservoir Dogs.
You were cool.
Well, let's take a look at which posters we chose as our three favorites in the big picture. Take it away.
Quentin Tarantino's movie posters are just as stylish as the films themselves. His calling card, 1992's Reservoir Dogs, came with this attention-grabbing one-sheet of five thugs that look too cool for school, dressed in black suits, skinny ties, and shades. A great poster for sure, but it conveyed none of the blood-soaked carnage that would be found in the movie itself. This retro-style one-sheet for 1994's Pulp Fiction was the most fitting of all. Designed to look like an old, cheap, tacky pulp book from the 40s and 50s, but Uma Thurman's sexy cigarette-smoking pose, complete with a loaded gun front and center, really captured the tone of this masterpiece. And for 2007's double feature mashup, Grindhouse, directors Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez devised this stylish one-sheet for Planet Terror and Death Proof that would have fit right at home alongside the exploitation flicks that they were tipping their hats to.
Such a great poster, that Grindhouse one.
Yeah, really. It would have fit right along any of those movies from back in the day. It's so cool.
So cool.
Moving on to The Player.
Yes, our favorite characters.
Quentin Tarantino has developed and created some of the most unforgettable characters in movie history.
Yep.
One of them we just talked about, worth another mention, Beatrice Kiddo.
The bride. Uma Thurman. We were talking just before about how she's a great female protagonist. I love her strength, her physicality, how she can kill anyone like that. She's super deadly. She knows the 5-point palm exploding, exploding technique.
Oh, yeah.
But she also shows the feminine side to her too, being a mother and missing her child, and also how hurt she was by what Bill did to her.
Oh, yeah.
Great performance. I also love, of course, Jules.
Jules, Samuel Jackson from 1994's Pulp Fiction.
So
cool. Great hair, great attitude, and as his delivery of Ezekiel 25:17, he starts off calm, and it builds and it builds and it builds, exploding with those gunshots. That scene alone solidified Jules as one of the greatest and most unforgettable characters, definitely in the last 20 years. And finally,
Hans Landa
from Inglourious Basterds.
The Jew Hunter, Christoph Waltz. Oh, such an incredible performance. We'll be talking more about him in a second, but I love how he changes like this. Like, one minute he's happy, he's fun, you think he's a nice guy, and then boom, he changes and he's quite evil. And I think for a movie that involves Hitler, for him to be the most evil character is saying something.
Worse than Hitler. 9999999. That's so great.
Oh gosh. But I want to tell you about something really cool that's been happening on the Schmoville Facebook page,
yeah,
which everyone should be a fan of if they're not already. They've been doing these great brackets.
Oh, they're the best.
They're the best. They've been taking two different characters and pitting them against each other and then seeing what everybody chooses. So in the first round, they had eight different sets. People, it was like the wolf versus Pai Mai, something like that. And people would debate which one they think is best. And in the second round, they had four, including like Hans Landa versus Calvin Candy. And then the third was the championship between two of the best characters, according to Schmoville, The Bride versus Jules.
And who won?
Jules.
Jules won.
Yes.
Wow.
Jules
See?
Winfield. Yes.
Wow, Jules over the Bride. That
and
must have been a tough call.
He is the baddest mother ever yeah. in all of Schmoville.
Well, listen, we want to thank, definitely want to thank our friends like Steve Zissou.
Rasika.
They're the best. Tyler, Michael. I mean, all you guys are
and
just so great.
And everyone for getting involved, because we love getting onto our Facebook and seeing that people are talking about it and they're excited about what we're doing. And that just makes me so happy.
Listen, that's what Profiles is all about. We want you to have just as much fun as we are. We want to be involved with you guys. I mean, that's why we try to take as much time as we can to interact with you, because you're just like us. You're film geeks.
We're film geeks.
We're film geeks. I don't know if you noticed that, yeah, but we are.
Something gave that away.
But,
t-shirt.
You know, how much of a geek are you? How much do you know your Quentin Tarantino? This is like our least favorite part, but still a very fun part
quiz
of the show.
Quiz okay.
show, because we want to look cool.
All right, give
okay.
it to me.
Here it is. Are you ready? Which actor was supposed to play Donnie Donowitz?
Okay,
in Inglourious Bastards, but had to turn it down due to scheduling conflicts.
All right, I'm bad at these.
Was it Jake Gyllenhaal, your number one fave?
Yeah.
Was it Chris Pine, my number one fave? Was it Adam Sandler, or was it Jim Carrey?
Oh, I'm going to say Adam Sandler.
Wow, she gets it. She gets, she scores. Way to go, Alicia Malone.
All righty, for you.
Yes.
Which color is Quentin's character in Reservoir Dogs? Is he Mr. Black, Mr. Blue, Mr. Brown, Mr. Yellow?
Mr. Yellow.
No, Mr. Brown.
Oh, man, I should have gotten that.
That's all right. Okay, well, we're waiting for a very special guest to call in. But in the meantime, we're going to go to Fast Five number 3, which is, if we've got it ready.
Ooh, that's a bingo.
We just say bingo.
We just say bingo.
Bingo. Inglourious Bastards, which might just be his masterpiece.
It is, in my opinion. You know why, Alicia? Because Inglourious Bastards is my personal number one favorite.
It is?
It is. Because
yeah,
I remember, listen, I remember when I saw all his other films, but nothing filled me with the exhilaration and the excitement that I felt watching Inglourious Bastards. Mm. This movie came out August 21st, 2009, was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Wow.
By the way, that happened the first year in decades when the Best Picture nomination category was opened up to more than just 5 movies.
Right.
So you had a movie like The Blind Side was also nominated, yeah, which I don't know what that was doing there. But it won, obviously, supporting actor for Christoph Waltz, who won every single award that year for which he was nominated. And it's just, it's such a great revenge fantasy.
Yeah.
And then at the very end of the film, when they shoot Hitler in the face, you're
what
are they doing?
I love, this is Quentin's version of how he would like to go have it all go down. I like that the final climax is in a movie theater. I love that Michael Fassbender's character is
a
movie critic.
Yeah.
And the casting as well. I mean, this was the first time I ever saw Daniel Brühl. And I'd heard of Michael Fassbender, but this was the first time I'd seen him in a big film like this.
Right.
He was brilliant in this movie.
Yeah.
And I love that it's a genre mishmash. It's a World War II film. It does also have that spaghetti Western element to it. And it's a lot of it is spoken in French and German, and they use real French and German actors. I love that. That lends a real authenticity to the words.
Well, Christoph Waltz spoke 4 languages in this movie. Spoke French, English, German, and Italian.
My gosh.
So no wonder he, one of the many reasons why he should have won. But yeah, I was with you. I discovered Michael Fassbender in this movie, mm-hmm, Daniel Brühl, and Melanie Laurent.
Yeah.
Who was Shoshana. And here's an interesting observation.
Shoshana.
Are you ready? Okay, go with me on this, Alicia.
Okay,
so while I was redoing my research, best kind of research you could do, by the way, rewatching all these great movies.
Not really work.
I mean, I should pay you to do that. But while I was watching Inglourious Bastards, and I was watching Kill Bill Volume 2, in Kill Bill Volume 1, there's a scene where Daryl Hannah goes to the bride, and she's going to kill the bride while she's in the coma. And over the phone, Bill says, "No, don't do that.
Mm.
Don't kill her this way.
Mm-hmm.
She deserves better." And he lets her go. And of course, that comes back to haunt Bill.
Yes.
Well, in Inglourious Bastards, the beginning of the film, after that long interrogation, right, of the French farmer, that he lets Shoshana go.
Au revoir, Shoshana.
And what happens?
She comes back and she kills them all.
Right, she kills Hitler!
She kills Hitler.
So it's very interesting that these two movies outside of Grindhouse that are back-to-back and have very similar mistakes by these leads.
And I say it is his masterpiece because it really shows he'd mastered his craft, not only the style with the way the things looked, the era that it was set in, where he put the camera, but also the substance too with the great dialogue and the characters and some fantastic scenes in this one too. And he worked on this script for 10 years.
10 years, and boy was it worth the wait. Well, my favorite scene of all his movies is in this film, and I'll get to that.
Yeah, you will get to that. It also has five different chapters, doesn't it?
Five chapters, a five-act structure.
Once Upon a Time in Nazi-occupied France. And different perspectives. I like how it changes in between each scene.
Yeah, and that first scene again with the French farmer is unbelievable.
Well, Stacey Howard, who writes for SchmoesKnow.com, which you should go to every single day when you want to get your dose of movie news, she says about Inglourious Basterds, Tarantino has such a sense of fun, albeit aggressively violent fun, that he's able to inject into all his movies. This is one of the best examples. Christoph Waltz as a villain is delightfully sinister, and the way Tarantino is about to give exposition is able to give exposition and character development through inventive imagery, camera angles, and music, encourage the audience to feel all the emotions he wanted them to feel. Disgust, dark humor, a sense of righteousness when justice was served. What a ride.
What a ride indeed. Rachel Cushing has this to say. Inglourious Basterds is my favorite, mostly because it took me by surprise, and Tarantino hadn't done that for me since Pulp Fiction. Mm. I can distinctly remember the feeling of awe and glee I felt in the theater when I saw he actually killed Hitler. Yeah, I'm with you on that. For some reason, I did think Tarantino was going to rewrite history, so when he did, I had a genuine gut reaction to it, and I loved it.
That's great.
And of course, I have rewatched it many, many times. I've also come to love it for all the reasons. It was so amazing. The tongue-in-cheek villain played by the delicious Christoph Waltz. The fantastic arc of Melanie Laurent's Shoshana and Tarantino's wonderful use of pacing. Only he can master the slow, creeping tension of a scene and then literally explode into gory violence, which is a foreshadow of my favorite scene, which I'll get to soon.
I love that. Well, this week, The Good, The Bad, The Ugly. It's really hard to choose.
There's no ugly. There's only an underrated movie.
Yeah, and that is?
That is Jackie Brown.
Yeah, we both agree on this one.
Jackie Brown, which came out on, again, Christmas Day 1997. Boy, he loves Christmas time.
Yeah.
The only nomination this movie got was for Best Supporting Actor for Robert Forster.
Brilliant.
And the amazing thing about this film is how, compared to all Quentin Tarantino's other movies, how basically straightforward this is, right?
A lot more about characters rather than style, but it also had that blaxploitation feel, that 70s style, the crime film. I love Pam Grier in this. Great cast too. Robert
Great
De Niro.
Cast. Yep. Sam Jackson. And Richard Fonda, by the way. It also has, by the way, the lowest body count of any Quentin Tarantino movie. Only four people died in this movie.
That's right.
You had De Niro, Richard Fonda, Samuel L. Jackson, and of all people, I couldn't believe he was in this movie when I went back and rewatched it, Chris Tucker.
Yeah.
I mean, it was unbelievable that he was in this movie. But listen, the problem with Jackie Brown is that it had to follow Pulp Fiction.
Which is a hard act to follow, but by itself, it's such a great film, and Schmoville agrees with us. Joshua Stein says, I love Jackie Brown because there's an element of blaxploitation to it that I love. It has the elements of Tarantino that I love, like his dialogue and his unique directing, but this felt different in a good way. It's not his best, but still great. Plus, it has memorable characters like Jackie Brown, Max Cherry, and Ordell Robbie.
And Brian Turriff says, its deliberate pacing is a slow burn, building the story and making you care about the characters. This is Tarantino's least cartoonish film, exemplified by Forster's Max Cherry, supremely confident at what he does, yet caught between his emotions and the task at hand. Brian, say hi to Mary for me.
All right. Well, your right stuff, Mr. Mance, you mentioned before that has something to do with the film we've already talked about.
Yes, my right stuff, my favorite scene in a Quentin Tarantino movie is from Inglourious Basterds, and it is the scene at the French pub when Michael Fassbender blows his cover because he holds up three fingers in the wrong way. But what I love about that scene is when the Nazi major comes and sits next to them and they get into this card game and is really uncomfortable. No one wants him there, but the card game keeps going. It keeps going. And then just the way that the scene plays out.
So tense, because you know he's going to get caught out, but you're not sure how.
I mean, and just the way that the dialogue of that scene when Michael Fassbender is outed because of the way he holds up his fingers, and he literally says, "Well, this is it, old boy. I hope you don't mind if I go out speaking to the kings." And the major's like, "By all means, Captain." And then it explodes into this bloodshed. Oh, it's such a great, great scene. The way it just builds, just like one of our schmoes just pointed out just now, the way it built to an explosive, bloody payoff.
I love that film. I love all of Quentin Tarantino's movies. It's so fun getting to talk about him. And we should point out that we actually almost got to chat to Quentin himself.
Oh, but he was too busy.
He's too busy on a little film called The Hateful Eight.
The Hateful Eight.
Which
he's
I guess
prepping.
We can forgive him.
We can forgive him for that. He's prepping Hateful Eight, but he did wish us the best on our profiles.
Isn't that amazing?
On Quentin Tarantino. He knows about us.
He knows about us. We've both spoken to Quentin before in different means, but just for him to know that we are doing a profiles on him and for him to know that this show exists and to send his best...
That is pretty damn cool.
That is pretty damn cool. Okay, should we keep things moving with our...
Let's keep moving.
Number two in our Fast Five.
Number two. Well, I don't
know, and then...
Cuts the off the ear and puts gasoline dogs. Over him. Reservoir Dogs. Boy, this movie, what a breakthrough for Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. Came out October 23rd, 1992. And again, amazing. We never actually see the heist.
It completely plays with all the conventions of a usual crime film. As you said, it shows the before and the after of the heist, but not the heist itself. Should we pause talking about Reservoir Dogs?
We
have a special guest on the line.
We have a special guest on the phone right now joining us here on Profiles. We would love to welcome Oscar nominee Robert Forster, who played Max Cherry in 1997's Jackie Brown. Robert, you are on with Alicia and Scott on Profiles. Hello.
Hey, how are you, Alicia? How are you, Scott?
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for joining us. We were just talking about how much we love Jackie Brown. You know, it's been 17 years. How proud are you still of that film?
Well, that was a life changer for me. You know, actors live in hopes that something will come along that makes a big difference and throws them a career that they've been hoping for. And my career had come and gone by then, by 1997, I guess it was. And I had a very slim strategy at that point, and the strategy was that some kid who liked me growing up would turn into a real good filmmaker and give me a good part.
Wow.
And if you can imagine that coming true, now you know what the value of prayer is all about.
Well, we know that this was actually not the first attempt that you had at working with Quentin. That started a bit earlier, and I was wondering if you could tell us the story behind that.
You know, I heard about Quentin Tarantino from a filmmaker by the name of Bill Lustig, and I'd worked for him a bunch of times. Lustig, he did exploitation movies, and one of them was Vigilante. And he called me up one day and he said, "I just bought a script from a kid you never heard of. And this script is called True Romance. And the guy I bought it from said, well, think of Robert Forster for a part in it." And Lustig sent me the script, and it was broken up in a way that I'd never seen a script before. It was out of sequence. And I just got through reading it when Lustig called me back and said they took the movie away from me. Somebody who recognized it was great, and they're going to make it linear the way usual movies are structured. And so don't worry about whatever it is this guy Tarantino had in mind for you, because it's not going to happen. That was a movie called, I think it was called True Romance. Isn't that the one the Scott brothers
yeah.
did?
Yep, Tony Scott.
And then sometime after that, I got a call to audition for Reservoir Dogs. And I said to myself, all right, I'm gonna kill this. And of course, I was real ready. I went in there and I thought I knocked it out of the park. But when I was finished with the audition, Quentin came out of the room behind me and said, hey, you know, that was nice. And he was his enthusiastic self. What a guy. And he said, look, this isn't going to work out. He said, that part, the part that I read for, is going to go to the guy that I dedicated the script to. What was his name?
Lawrence Tierney.
Gangster in that movie.
Yeah, Lawrence Tierney.
Pardon?
Lawrence Tierney?
No. The old gangster in Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right. So
played by the guy he did this. Oh, God, how come it's, you see, this is another product of old age. okay, so Tierney. Tierney.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't get that part. Some years later, I'm sitting in the restaurant, and my career is really, really at the bottom. I have no agent, no manager, no lawyer, no nothing. And in walks Tarantino into this this coffee shop, and I hail him over. He comes over. We blah, blah for a while. I asked him what he was doing. He said, I'm writing an adaptation of Rum Punch. He said, why don't you read it? I think that is the exact moment at which he said to himself, God, maybe this guy is the right guy for the part. 6 months or so later, I arrived one morning at that coffee shop, and Quentin was sitting in my seat. And as I approached the table, he picked up a script and he handed it to me and he said, read this, see if you like it. It is one of those things that you don't expect to happen, but there it was.
Wow.
And when you were actually working with Quentin, did your impression of him change, or what was he like to work with? Is he always that enthusiastic?
Oh, yes. This guy is, he's what he appears to be. He's a real good guy and very, very, very smart. And he may have gained some confidence since the first time, but he seemed to have plenty of confidence when I met him for the first time with Reservoir Dogs. He did things just to show what kind of confidence this guy has. He gave everybody at the top of the day a shot list. Now, a shot list is usually confined to the cinematographer and the director and one or two and the assistants, you know. But he gave a shot list, handcrafted and Xerox, to everybody on the set, including the grips and craft service. Everybody on that set knew what we were trying to get done today. And this isn't something that you do if you're at all scared. He played music on the set for real important scene when Jackie Brown steps out of the prison and walks toward me. And in those moments, I get hit with that feeling. You know the feeling I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
And he played music for that, the kind of music and or the exact music that he would put into the movie. This guy was full of very new stuff, unafraid, and that was obvious.
Well, take us back to that moment. On that morning, when you found out, Robert Forster, that you were nominated for an Academy Award for Jackie Brown. Take us through that morning. Were you up watching the nominations? How did you find out?
You know,
what a day.
Thanks. Oh, God. About 1 o'clock in the morning before that announcement, I got a call, my friend Frank. He says, what are you doing? I said, I'm sleeping. He says, you mean you're not going to wait for the announcement? I said, no. Listen, if it happens, somebody will call me up. He said, don't worry, it's going to happen. 5:30 or so is when they announced. My eyes actually did open up around 5:25 or so. And as I looked at the clock, I didn't get up, but I kept my eyes open and closed. And I said, okay, 5:30 came and went, 5:40 came and went. 5:41 or some number like that, the phone rang.
Oh, boy.
I said, oh, wow. No. Gee, don't tell me. And it wasn't anybody official. It was my first wife who called and said, Bob, you got nominated.
Wow. Mm.
The phone immediately, the call waiting immediately started beeping. I said, June, I got to go. It was somebody else. I could not get off the phone for 30 or 40 minutes. I just one call after another. Everybody I'd ever known.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
Around 45 minutes after, I finally got a call from the publicist who said, the car's outside. They're waiting for you. Why don't you pick up your phone? I said, I couldn't. She said, there were too many people calling. She said, the car is downstairs waiting. I said, for what? She said, you got to do interviews.
Yes.
And so quickly, I leaped into the best wardrobe I could come up with. At the time, I was, quite broke. And I ran downstairs. I jumped in the car. They took me around. I might have done, I think, 29 interviews.
Wow.
On that day.
Wow.
Only the last one was over, and the car was driving me home. And I remember the warm sun coming in that car window, and I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have a cell phone. Somebody else had a cell phone. I guess it must have been the driver had a cell phone. They were calling me all day, telling me where I was going and what was going to happen next. But finally, it was all over, and as I was driving home, the warm, warm feeling of inclusion.
Wow.
That when you finally say to yourself, holy mackerel, this really happened, and I am now included.
Wow,
and
what a
so
great story.
That was that day and that moment. One small thing,
yep.
Frank, the same guy, the morning of the Academy Awards proper, called me up. It was at 1 o'clock in the morning. I guess that's his best time. He was drunk. He called me up and he said, hey, now look. He said, tomorrow when they open up the envelope, somebody's going to say, and the winner is Robin Williams. Don't jump out of your seat too quick.
Wow, what a whirlwind of a time. It's amazing. It's so great to hear all your memories. I was just wondering before we let you go, do you have a favorite Quentin Tarantino movie?
Oh, Alicia, I think you should answer that one for me.
It's hard to pick, isn't it? Well, we were talking about how great Jackie Brown is. That's one of our favorites.
Yep, it's mine too, and for all the good reasons.
Yes, so good.
Well, listen, Robert, thank you so much for calling in. I just before I let you go, one of my favorite movies of all time is The Black Hole.
Yes.
I love that movie, my friend.
I love that movie. It was a remake, as you know, of the Jules Verne undersea adventure, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the space version.
Yep. Mm.
I was thrilled to be in it.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us, and you have a great day, and thank you so much for sharing your memories and your insight into Jackie Brown. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Alicia.
Thanks so much.
Have fun.
Thanks. That's so good.
That was cool.
Robert Forster. And he was so great in Jackie Brown.
Yeah. Max Cherry, again, I mean, that was just such a well-developed character, perfectly acted. And it was such a, I mean, for him to get nominated for that role.
Yes.
I mean, that was the only Oscar nomination that movie got, and it was for him.
I know. And interesting that he was almost in Reservoir Dogs, which is what we were talking about beforehand. So I want to continue with that.
Let's keep going.
That has a lot to say about this movie. So Reservoir Dogs, obviously, it was Quentin's first film. He was planning to shoot it for only $30,000 with friends. But then Harvey Keitel, when he got involved, that meant they could bump up the budget to something like $1.5 million,
that's right.
And originally, I think they weren't going to show the heist because it would have taken too much money, but then they decided that it was kind of cool, and I totally agree.
Well, let's talk about the scene that is the standout scene of that movie, the scene that we bumped into this part with, where Mr. Blonde is torturing the cop,
He's
cuts
so cool.
off his ear, douses him with gasoline, And it is, and you had a poster of this guy yes. on your wall.
Plus, I love the music in this movie. It's interesting to hear Robert talk about how Quentin would play the music while they were shooting. Because the thing I loved, I liked the K-Billy super sounds of the 70s. But the music, especially in that scene, contrasts so much with the brutal violence that is going on.
It sure did.
And I know Michael actually had a really tough time shooting that scene.
He did have a tough time because apparently at that time he had just become a dad. Mm-hmm. So when the guy playing the cop revealed, and this was not scripted, that he was a new father,
right.
it took him out of the moment. It took him out of character, and he had a little bit of a hard time moving on with it. But of course, move on he did.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, oh, amazing film. Spoiler alert, everybody dies.
Everyone dies. It has all the hallmarks of what we now know is Quentin Tarantino's movies.
Including the fact that this movie did take place in the same universe as Pulp Fiction, because mm-hmm. not only was Vic Vega, Michael Madsen, the brother of Vincent Vega, but on the radio, there's a mention of Jack Rabbit Slims.
Yay, which so, we mentioned before.
We want to go there.
I mean, such a brutal film, but such cool dialogue.
Yes,
my God.
What are
and
our
great
friends?
Characters, too. And our friends at Schmoville, Spencer Drake said, although I've seen Pulp Fiction more, Reservoir Dogs is the one that sticks with me the most. He was able to tell such a riveting story and use his actors to their full capability while pretty much using one location, and that is incredible.
Well, George McCann says the film is like a beautiful, horrifying stage play in the best possible way.
Yes.
The tipping scene is still my favorite Quentin Tarantino scene.
And
yes, I love that. And the stuck in the middle scene still scares me.
Like me.
Us too. Although I stand by my theory that Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction are one movie.
Mm.
The timeline adds up if you dive into all the Easter
just
eggs.
Just what we were talking
just
about.
Just what we were talking about.
And you know, George mentioned that it kind of feels like a stage play. A little bit of trivia for you. Michael Fassbender was such a fan of Reservoir Dogs that he actually produced and starred in a stage play version.
Whoa.
It all comes full circle.
Full circle, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, well, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs are two films that are often copied.
But never replicated, but some have come close.
There are some good directors who do a similar thing. So
Adaptation.
Let's talk Guy Ritchie.
Guy Ritchie came pretty close with not one, but two films. One was Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he remade his movie again into a movie called Snatch.
Both and not so well with Rock and Roller.
Rock and Roller, yeah, I didn't like that movie at all. But Lock, Stock, and Snatch, two solid films, Tarantino-esque, but not Tarantino.
Yeah, he had great style and cool dialogue. Robert Rodriguez is another one. Of course, he's a longtime collaborator with Quentin Tarantino, as we saw with the Grindhouse films and also Sin City as well. They met at Toronto with their first movies in 1992, and they became fast friends. They definitely both have that brutal, stylized violence about them.
You know, if you watch From Dusk Till Dawn,
yes,
the first half of that movie, which, by the way, Quentin Tarantino acted in that
yes,
film.
Yes, exactly.
But the first half,
I thought he did a good job.
I thought he did good, and I liked that movie a lot. It came out in February of 1996.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I know that, but I do.
Rain Man.
But From Dusk Till Dawn is a solid movie. The first half of that film is as close to like a Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs kind of movie that any filmmaker ever got. But then, of course, the second half just turned into this big vampire Gorefest.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was cool.
It was fun.
Doug Liman is another one, especially Go.
Go. Go is a movie that came out in April of 1999.
He knows all the release dates.
But listen, Go is a good film.
It is. And it's got that intersecting storylines. Same as Pulp Fiction.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question. What is your take on some of the films that Tarantino wrote? Like, what is your take
True Romance? I love True Romance. I really do. It's so interesting when you hear, and I've heard that before, how it did originally start out in this non-linear style, and then it got put together in linear style. I'd love to see that other version also. But Quentin Tarantino is a brilliant writer. He has delivered some of the most incredible dialogue and most memorable dialogue on screen, I think, out of anyone. And True Romance, one of my favorites that he wrote.
Now, I know that you've talked about this in other places, but do you think that Tarantino is better as a screenwriter or as a director?
It's such a hard thing, isn't it? Because he has such great style as a director, but For me, I would probably say his writing, because his dialogue is just so cool, and nobody can do it the way he does.
No one can do it, no.
But that being said, I mean, his
directing. But it's such a narrow margin above the directing.
I know, and I think that's when it's the combination of the two that really works. But True Romance shows that someone else could direct it, and it is still just as cool. You're so cool.
You're so cool. But he almost directed True Romance.
Yeah,
he
I almost, know.
That's an interesting story. Yes. Well, we are at that time. Fast Five pulling in at number one. Woo! What is it?
And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Pow, 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 pow. Pow. Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction came out in October 14th, 1994, which means, ladies and gentlemen in Schmoville, we are at the exact 20th anniversary of Pulp Fiction when it first was released in the United States. Movie won the Palme d'Or, the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, was nominated for 7 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director, and it lost to...
Forrest Gump.
What?
How?
What?
How?
Come on!
I like Forrest Gump, but Pulp Fiction, this was a game changer.
Game changer.
I think it is one of the most influential movies in the past 20 years.
No question.
This really cemented Quentin Tarantino as the coolest director around. The nonlinear storyline, like we talked before, to me when I first saw Pulp Fiction, as I said, that seemed so fresh. All those storylines jumping back and forth in time, which took a second to realize what was happening.
Yeah, when you were watching it and you watched the scene when Butch kills Vincent in his bathroom.
And then the next scene.
The next scene, there he is, alive and well.
Yeah.
You know, like you're just like, wait a minute.
It's so much fun to try to piece together the chronological order.
Yeah.
And also try to figure out what's in the briefcase?
What is in the briefcase indeed?
I like the idea that it's Marcellus Wallace's soul.
Yeah, me too. What appeals to you about that?
Well, I think it's something so different. I like that it's shiny and gold. And also, it makes sense when you see the back of Ving Rhames' head, which has a bandage, because apparently that's where your soul comes out. But they do say that was just because he had a scar that he wanted to cover up. And also Tim Roth, when he sees the briefcase,
and
he just goes,
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And the combination, by the way,
and
the combination.
He sold his soul to the devil, and it makes sense. Because he is so evil.
He sold his soul for the devil, and they say that
don't
when you sell your soul,
massage.
Your soul gets ripped out of your neck, hence the bandage on the back of Marcellus Wallace's neck. And then the combination for the briefcase was 666.
Yes.
Don't you love it? Whether or not the director or the filmmakers disagree or shoot down these theories, don't you love it when a movie like this opens that interpretation up, that people will start piecing together their own theories behind a movie?
Looking into it.
They look into it. I mean, we've talked about Harrison Ford last time, about Blade Runner.
And The Shining with Kubrick. Oh. I love when people are trying to figure things out. This movie was the first independent film to make over $200 million at the box office. It, of course, revitalized John Travolta's career.
No question.
Completely turned that around. Uma Thurman and Samuel L. Jackson became bigger stars after this movie, and it also launched the Weinsteins, like talking before with Miramax. This was one of the first films that they produced and not just imported, and that showed that they were really a force to be reckoned with. Fox Force 5.
And also, hey, the soundtrack.
Oh,
the soundtrack
so cool.
for this movie
the
is great. Oh, it's one
I
of the best soundtracks.
I played it on
repeat. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, the soundtrack with the surf music, Miserlou by Dick Dale and the Deltones. Surf music goes all the way through, even during the ending credits, and just his love for these kind of soundtracks. All his movies have great soundtracks.
The quotable dialogue. I think the F word is said something like 256 times.
But this bizarro version of LA.
Yeah.
Like, for example, when Butch is riding in the cab with Esmeralda, whatever her name is, the cab driver.
Yeah.
But they're in the cab is yellow, that's in color, but the background behind them, the scene behind them, it's in black and white.
It's very film noir.
Very film noir, and it doesn't really mesh with the setting of the cab.
But it works.
But it works because it just sort of sets this whole bizarro version of LA.
And same with Vincent and Jules rocking around with the suit on.
Yes.
You think that they would be they would stand out a lot in LA, especially today because it is hot.
It is hot in LA, ladies and gentlemen. 110 degrees in the valley.
Woo, and in the studio as well. Well, Liam Logrand.
Liam!
Yay, Liam!
We love Liam!
We love Liam, and he loves Pulp Fiction. He said, the script was so original and unique with excellent dialogue and some of the most creative characters ever written. Samuel L. Jackson, John Travolta, Uma Thurman, and Harvey Keitel, the Wolf, give the performances of their career and are the biggest highlights of the film to me. It also had a significant influence on my life, as I would never have discovered my passion for films if I never watched it. I almost feel the same. I mean, Hitchcock was my first director that really blew my mind. But yeah. Pulp Fiction with Quentin Tarantino again made me realize just how important a director is when it comes to a movie.
The style, director as the artist.
The vision, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And my friend Brian Turf again weighs in on Pulp Fiction, saying it was the first movie Tarantino movie he ever saw on opening weekend with some friends. Didn't know much about the movie other than it looked cool. The most memorable movie theater experience I ever had was sitting in an old large theater in Chicago and watching the entire audience grab their armrests and lean forward in unison while Travolta raises the needle of adrenaline over Uma Thurman's unconscious body. What a scene. The movie felt completely new despite all of its callbacks to earlier movies and music. A classic. Brian, again, say hi to Mary.
Love it. Okay. Love it. Before we go, that was our top five. Let's just recap. Fast Five. So number five,
Django Unchained. Number four, Kill Bill Volume 2. Number three, Inglourious Bastards. Number two, Reservoir Dogs. Number one, Pulp Fiction.
Woo! Hope you guys enjoyed it. Hope you agree with our choices. Or let us know what you like, what you don't like. Follow us both on Twitter at Alicia Malone
and at Movie Mance. And make sure you rate and review us on iTunes. This is very important. We have so many great suggestions from you, so many great filmmakers, actors, actresses, and a great idea that we should dissect over the course of an hour, an entire movie. We want to be able to do all these things. We can only do it with your support. The ratings and reviews on iTunes. Subscribe to YouTube.
Yeah.
Share our video.
Podcast.
Go to Schmoes Know. Watch Schmoes Know, a movie show every Thursday. And again, thank you, thank you, thank you. And please love our Facebook fan page, Profiles with Malone and Mance. So
next time.
Show me the money! Tom Cruise!
Great actor. We cannot wait to talk about. I have no idea what we're going to choose for our Fast Five.
It's going to be tough. He's made so many great movies. He's a great actor. A lot to talk about with Tom Cruise. Biggest star on the planet by far. Mm-hmm. We'll see you next time on Profiles.
Bye!
From producers Christian Harloff, Mark Ellis, and the entire Schmoes Know Network crew, we would like to thank you for listening to Profiles with Alicia Malone and Scott Mads. Special thanks to Kevin Undergaro and Maria Menounos, the author of Every Girl's Guide to Diet and Fitness, in stores now. Be sure to subscribe to Profiles on iTunes and rate and review the show. To get other Schmoes Know Network episodes, movie news, and join the conversation, be sure to visit schmoesknow.com. I'm the Pit Boss, and this has been a presentation of the Schmoes Know Network.